Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating brought to America's shores. I'm John Donvan. On this stage tonight, as your host and, more importantly, your moderator for another in our series of smart and sparkling debates on topics that matter. The motion before us is guns reduce crime, which may sound counterintuitive, but that actually depends on how this debate goes, and it may actually sound intuitive, again, depending on how the debate goes. We are joined also on this stage by two teams of debaters of three members each of them superbly qualified to be taking part in this discussion. You are also a part of the evening in that this is a contest. It is a contest of persuasion. These debaters are here to influence your views, to try to change your minds, in fact, if you disagree with their position. We are going to poll you twice during the evening, once in a moment and once close to the end of the debate, in order to see where you stand on this motion that guns reduce crimes. Each of the debaters will have opening statements. After the opening round, our second round will be a head-to-head debate in which the debaters will debate among themselves. And then at the end of the debate, once again, we will poll you to see where we stand on the numbers. There will be a two-minute summary statement by each debater to wrap up the event. And at that point, we will announce the winners based on your judgment. So with that said, let the debate begin. Only rarely does a man of ideas witness in his own lifetime the opportunity to actually see one of his ideas change history. For a scholar who wrote a controversial book in the 1990s arguing that where there is more gun ownership, there is actually less crime, that history-making experience took place. Legislatures across the country took hold of the ideas in that book and passed laws allowing for the carrying of concealed weapons. That indeed was history-making. The author of that idea and of the book that contained those ideas is our first debater tonight, speaking for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, John Lott.
Guns cause bad things to happen, and guns make it easier for bad things to happen. But guns also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening. Guns make it easier for you to harm somebody. But guns also make it easier for you to deter criminals from attacking to begin with and turn out to be the most effective way for somebody to go and defend themselves when they're having to face a criminal by themselves. It'd be great if police were there all the time. My research finds that police are probably the single most important factor for reducing crime. But I think one thing the police understand themselves is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crimes occurred. Even if they're able to call 911, you know, fast response times are measured in 8 or 9 or 10 minutes. And it can be a lifetime for many people. A lot of people have a pretty good idea of the bad things that happen with guns. But you also have, if you look at surveys done by the Justice Department, you'll find maybe about 400, 450,000 crimes are committed each year with guns. By contrast, you have similar types of surveys that indicate that people use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. So about 4 to 5 times more frequently, people use guns to stop crime than guns are used in the commission of crime. We all want to try to take guns away from criminals. I mean, one obvious thing that's been tried many times is to go and have gun bans. The problem is that when you go and pass something like that, the question you have to ask yourself many times is who's most likely to obey the rule? If it turns out that it's the most law-abiding citizens who obey the rule and turn in their guns relative to criminals, you can actually increase in violent crime. And Washington, D.C. Is one important example of that. In 1976, September 76, D.C. passed a ban banning handguns. It didn't go into effect till February 77. But only once after 76 was D.C.'s murder rate as low as it was in 76. Only twice in 2 years after that was D.C.'s robbery rate as low as it was in 76. It's not just D.C., though. In Chicago, Chicago's murder and robbery rates were falling prior to the 1982 ban, and they rose afterwards. They rose relative to other cities. But it's just not in the United States. Worldwide, time after time, and it'd be interesting to have people try to show an example where this isn't true, when you pass bans, you see increases in violent crime rates. Now, one thing people often do is they look across countries and they say, well, look, England has a relatively low gun ownership rate, has a relatively high murder rate, even if their violent crime rate is twice what we are in the United States. And they may point to Japan or Germany or other countries, and they say the United States has more guns, more violent crime. But the thing you have to take into account is these other countries had much, much lower violent crime rates prior to bans going into effect. And what you see time after time when these bans go into effect, either drop, violent crime rates no longer drop, or they begin to start to go up, as you've seen in England and other countries.
Thank you, John Lott. One of the safest major cities in the United States is Seattle, thanks in great measure to the work done by its police force under the leadership of a chief who has led the city to a 40-year low in violence. That said, problems persist there as everywhere else, especially among young offenders, a point brought home to the chief of police in Seattle after, in an anecdote he shared with us, he was doing some after Christmas Day shopping at a mall, and when he returned to his car, it had been broken into, and the one item stolen from his car was his gun. It's firsthand experience, and certainly of everyone on our panel, no one has actual more firsthand experience dealing with guns and crime than the Chief of Police of Seattle, Gil Kerlikowske.
Thank you, John. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I was worried that they wouldn't bring that story out, and I wanted to make sure that I did full disclosure. But the right to own and possess a gun in this country isn't a debatable issue, and it's not the topic. Reasonableness, though, and common sense do come into play. So you're going to hear from the other side about the deterrence effect, and in fact, John already brought a little bit about that up. More people carrying more guns will deter criminals. In other words, the criminals will think twice before confronting a potential victim. I wish criminals were that smart. Since we have almost in the neighborhood of 240 million guns in the United States, I would think that these criminals would already get the message that there are a lot of guns out there, and that if deterrence was in fact carried through, that we would have seen it by now, but we haven't. The other side of this coin is, will more armed citizens have an opposite effect on criminals? In other words, are the criminals going to now arm themselves, thinking that more and more and more people are carrying guns? Well, the union that represents the British Bobbies, who have been unarmed since Sir Robert Peel founded them, their union went forward and said, look, we do not want to be armed as Bobbies in the UK. Now, this was during a time of significant increases in crime, increases in knife crime, which is still going on. But they ask not to be armed. Now, there are some specialized units, certainly, but for the vast majority of the Bobbies in all of the UK, they are not armed, and they don't want to be because, one, they think it will only increase assaults on themselves, and that it will be a tit-for-tat or a proliferation of guns in the UK, which, like rabies, they have very few of. Who is carrying a gun now in this country, in the United States? Well, of course, law enforcement officers, state, federal, local. Security guards across all walks of life, from banks to armored car services, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that are already carrying guns. And then there's a whole other group of people, and those are the people that are able to go into their states and ask for a concealed firearms permit. There is a background check, it depends on the state, on what's done, but essentially they say, look, I sell jewelry, or I have a business that's been robbed, or, you know what, I want to be able to carry a gun, like in Florida. Let me close with this. When I was a young officer working the street in St. Petersburg, retired people, a young woman, 15 years old, intoxicated, beating and beating and beating on the front door of an elderly couple who had no phone. He turned to the thing that he felt could protect him the most, even though she was unable, of course, to get in, and she was just really an intoxicated kid who beating on the front door. He fired through the door and struck her.
Thank you, Gil Kerlikowske, arguing against the motion. As a lawyer representing the National Rifle Association, Stephen Halbrook has gone 3-for-3 before the Supreme Court in arguing firearms cases on behalf of the NRA. He is on our stage tonight to argue in this debate for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime. Stephen?
It's a real pleasure to be here. What I think we're advocating tonight, those of us on the side of the proposition, is that you should have freedom of choice to protect yourself if you decide to do that. One of the questions that was asked recently in the U.S. Supreme Court, the District of Columbia was trying to defend its handgun ban, and they said that it's okay to ban handguns and that all guns should have trigger locks and be disassembled and never loaded. And one of the Supreme Court justices asked the question, well, what if you hear the door crash in and you're fumbling for your reading glasses and trying to turn on the lamp and your hands are trembling? Maybe it would be a good idea to have a gun available if something like that happened. So the question is not whether everybody should have a gun, but the question is, should you have the ability to exercise that freedom of choice if you are a responsible citizen and that's your decision to do so? I'd like to use a couple of maybe legal cases to illustrate the point. You've heard D.C. became the murder capital of the United States after it enacted a handgun ban. There's no duty of the police to protect you. It's not just impossible for them to do so. It's not a legal duty. Right before the handgun ban in D.C. was enacted, there were three women who were in a boarding house, and they were broken into. And there was two individuals who, over a period of many, many hours, raped and robbed and otherwise assaulted them. They called 911 several times, and the police would come knock on the door, and nobody would respond. So this nightmare finally ended, and so they sued the D.C. government, and the courts ruled that there's no duty of government to protect any individual person. They have a duty to society at large, which is just kind of a useless concept. So there's no duty to protect you, and then the question becomes, well, maybe you would like to protect yourself. Maybe you'd like to at least have the legal right to do that, and that's what the Second Amendment is partly intended to guarantee. That's what the Supreme Court just held in D.C. versus Heller, that we do have an individual right to keep and bear arms, and it's a right. It's not something you have to do. It's not a duty, but it's something that you can do.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. I'm John Donvan of ABC News. And this is Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating brought to American shores. We have six panelists on the stage, three for and three against the motion, Guns Reduce Crime. We are halfway through our opening statements, and now let's let the debate continue. We are all wise enough in the ways of the world to know that the statement, statistics never lie, is a lie. The point being that honest scholars can look at the same numbers and disagree profoundly about what they mean. We heard from John Lott, whose specialty is looking at the statistics of gun crime. We are now going to be hearing from John Donahue, who is also a numbers man, but who looks at the numbers and comes up with dramatically different points of view on guns and crime. And through the academic journals, the two Johns have something of a feud going. But introducing you as our next speaker against the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, John Donahue.
Well, you mentioned a feud. I am a peaceful man, but let me just say that everything that you've heard from John in terms of the statistical claims are subject to serious challenge and refutation. Quickly on the D.C. Handgun ban issue. If you look at the numbers that John had put up, which was interesting, if he had actually showed you the number of murders in D.C., they had actually dropped. He showed you the rate. D.C. was depopulating tremendously in the 70s, and it was largely the flight of the affluent, so the group that had the lowest likelihood of engaging in crime. So crime was going to be if you use the rates that John showed, it was going to be trending up because the people remaining in the city had a much higher risk of crime. If you went for a number of years, you'd see there was a huge run-up in crime in D.C., as there was in Chicago and Philadelphia and New York, for that matter. But it had nothing to do with the topic we're talking about. That was crack cocaine, which had a tremendous criminogenic influence on crime. the idea that John Lott, and you will hear Gary Kleck argue that guns are being used constantly to thwart criminals by these gun-toting citizens is grotesquely misleading. John gave a number, two million. It's a complete fantasy. Now, John and I have debated on the issue of right to carry laws, laws that say citizens who have not yet been convicted of a felony or not yet been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital should be allowed to carry a gun wherever they want. John thinks this is a great idea, offers statistics to prove it. Let me just mention that in Texas, even if you have been committed to a mental hospital, if you can get a note from your doctor, they'll give you that concealed handgun permit. North Dakota really set a new low. They actually gave one of these permits to a blind permit holder. This is, to be frank, insanity. Now, I published a number of econometric studies, and virtually every top econometrician who has looked at this has sided with me and not with John Lott. The National Academy of Sciences convened a panel of talented experts who spent 2 years looking at John Lott's work. 15-1 in that panel of 16, they concluded the scientific evidence does not support the more guns, less crime proposition. The lone dissenter was someone who was not an econometrician, who admitted in his dissent that he wished he knew more econometrics, and who had previously testified as an expert witness on behalf of the execrable NRA. Thank you.
Thank you, John Donahue. When it comes to hot-button issues, we like to have easy pigeonholes to put people in. But our next speaker makes it difficult, a professor of criminology at Florida State. He is, a Democrat, a member of the ACLU, a member of Amnesty International. He describes himself as an environmental tree hugger. However, when it comes to this issue, this classic liberal is defying all expectations by arguing what is normally considered the conservative side, Gary Kleck, arguing for the motion that guns reduce crime.
The moral of that particular story is I didn't come to the pro side of this debate via my ideology. It's the most unnatural thing in the world from that standpoint. My way into this position is basically evidence-based. I'm boringly scholarly. Oddly enough, sometimes what you can learn from a debate is by listening to the silences, paying attention to what people would be expected to talk about but don't. Strictly speaking, the other side actually hasn't addressed the issue of the effectiveness of defensive gun use. The reason is the evidence is unanimous. It's rare in criminological research for the findings to be unanimous on anything, but they're unanimous on this one. Defensive gun use is effective in the sense that crime victims who use guns during a crime are less likely to be injured or killed and less likely to lose property than crime victims who adopt any other kind of strategy, including non-resistance. And this is so despite the fact that usually when people try to use guns for self-protection, they're doing it under tougher circumstances. They do it not because they're quick on the trigger, but because they're kind of facing really desperate circumstances. They're likely to be outnumbered. They're likelier to be facing offenders with weapons, including guns, than other victims. They're more likely than other victims to have already been injured. And out of desperation, with all of these handicaps against them, then they use guns in an attempt to defend themselves, and from that point on, they are not hurt. There's good reason why the chief's police officers carry guns. They're effective for self-protection, but it doesn't require the unique training and experience of police officers for it to be effective. It's effective basically for everybody. You may not have noticed, but there's actually more consensus among the six of us than might be evident at first. I don't think anybody really disputes the proposition that the effects of guns depends on who has them. I haven't heard anybody on the other side say that guns in the hands of non-criminals are just as bad as guns in the hands of criminals. It makes a huge difference. Basically, guns in the hands of non-criminals or in the hands of victims, regardless of any prior criminal behavior, reduce violence. They reduce it in the sense that once the gun is introduced by the victim, the offender stops aggressing, period. And so that's not a fantasy, as Professor Donahue would have you believe. It's about as firmly established a fact as we have to go on in this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary Kleck. Another defier of easy pigeonholing is the man who is president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He is a Republican, and he is the former mayor of Indianapolis. He has said that his position on gun control had a lot to do with nearly losing two close friends in a gun accident. This was during the time when they were all teenagers together. Now, all of these years later, we are pleased to introduce as our final speaker and speaking against the motion that guns reduce crime, Paul Hemke.
It's great to be here tonight. Just for the record, I was mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, not Indianapolis, but another great city in the state of Indiana. I came to this issue as a mayor. Not only had I had the experience when I was a teenager of seeing a friend get a bullet in the back because of the all-too-common incident of we found a gun, we didn't know it was loaded, which happens every day in this country, but as a mayor, I saw what happens in a community when there are so many guns. I had police officers. One case I still remember well. I got the call in the middle of the night from the police chief. Our labor relations director, a police chief, married to a police officer. They kept the gun at their headboard. They wanted to be safe. They knew how to use the gun. They were police officers. They had a fight, domestic quarrel. She ended up dead. That happens a lot in this country. Actually, the statistics show that if you've got a gun in your home, it's 22 times more likely to be used against you or a family member than to protect you. And part of the reason is that the world doesn't easily divide into the good guys and bad guys, because there's always sort of a chance that any of us can get angry, any of us can get drunk. And if the gun is there, what's going to happen with that gun? When you look at the arguments for the proponents here, basically they talk about these 2 million defensive uses. And as Professor Donahue said, that's a questionable number. Yes, it was based on probability sampling. There were 66 people who responded to a poll that said they used a gun defensively. 66, and then you extrapolate that by the adult population of the U.S., and you get 2 million gun uses. Just 66. When you do sampling and have such a small affirmative number, and then you multiply it by huge things, you get these outrageous things. Based on that, more people have been in flying saucers in this country. It shows what happens with statistics. The one statistic that doesn't lie are deaths. You have to do probability sampling for these other things, but when you look at deaths, you get the shocking statistics, that 32 people are killed with guns every day in this country. 30,000 people die from guns every year. Other countries in the world have the same level, generally, of rapes and of burglaries and of robberies and of assaults that we do. But we are far and away the most deadly country. In fact, if you think about it for a second, if the proposition were true that guns reduce crime, we should be the safest country in the world. And we're not. And it's because we do have so many guns, and those guns too easily get in the wrong hands. Let's do things to stop gun trafficking. Do you realize that you can go in and buy 81 of the same make and model of a gun tomorrow? And what do you think is going to happen when someone did that at Charlie Brown's gun store in Dayton, Ohio a few years back? 81 of the same make and model. They sell them out of the trunk of their car. Last thing I wanted to comment on is the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court case, while making it clear that gun bans are off the table, made it clear that we can have reasonable restrictions, that we can restrict who gets the guns, where they take the guns, how the guns are sold, how the guns are stored, and all the things that deal with guns. That's where this debate should come down.
Polling the audience before the debate on the motion, and we're going to put them up on the screen now. The motion being guns reduce crime, 13% of you supported this motion before the debate, 60% of you opposed the motion, and 27% were undecided. We'll be polling you again toward the end of the debate to see whether any minds have been changed. I want to go to John Lott. Your work embodies this motion that guns reduce crime, and your statistical work embodies that motion. And yet tonight, I heard some of the fundamental work you've done referred to as a fantasy, and I heard the question raised, if guns prevent crime, why isn't this the most safe nation in the world? What is the answer to that, and what about the fantasy issue?
I'll just take the fantasy issue first. There are lots of academics who have looked at the relationship between concealed handgun laws and crime rates. And if you look at papers published in refereed academic journals by economists and criminologists, you'll find about 70% of them find that when right to carry laws get passed, there's drops in violent crime rates. About 30% say there's no change that's there. And then there's no one, not one refereed academic journal that I know of, that finds that there's a bad effect from these. So there's a lot of people that have looked at this in many different ways.
John, you're ignoring the National Academy of Science panel.
I'm happy to get
15-1, including some of the top econometricians in the country, and their conclusion was your work is not supported
by the
scientific evidence.
None of them were experts on it. Their opinions on that issue have absolutely nothing to do with it. John's talking about what experts thought.
Just to respond to the National Academy of Sciences, I mean, this was a panel set up by the Clinton administration. I don't think it was unbiased.
This was not a panel set up by
the
Clinton administration.
It was started there. But the point is, what James Q. Wilson, who's this hack that you were referring to, and I think a lot of people would regard James Q. Wilson as probably the top criminologist in the country. He was the person who was dissenting on this. And what Jim showed was that if you look at every single one of the National Academy of Sciences estimates on the impact of right to carry laws on murder rates, every single one of their own estimates showed that right to carry laws reduced murder rates. And if you looked at their other things, virtually all their other estimates for all the other types of crimes showed reductions in those.
John,
I have
to report.
There was no estimate, not one estimate.
I have the report right in front of me, and it does not support what you just said.
Is it true or is it not true that every regression, every estimate that they had on right to carry and murder showed a drop? Is there one estimate that they showed it didn't fall statistically?
Yeah, there are some, maybe not statistically significant, but the But the bottom line, John, is, as the panel suggested, the elephant in the room was crack cocaine. Rural states that did pass these laws did not experience the big run-up in crime. And when you do your analysis, it is the difference between the flat performance in the rural states and the increases in crime that generates that result. That's why James Q. Wilson was outvoted 15-1.
Look, okay, I think we have impasse on this. And I want to go to Chief Kerlikowske, Seattle Police Chief, because you were talking about British bobbies being unarmed and preferring that in many situations because they felt being armed would invite assault. And yet Gary Kleck, arguing for the motion, said, why are police armed in the first place unless it is to deter assault? Chief, can you take that on?
Yes, I can. And getting away from the statistics and going to the police officers are highly trained with firearms. They practice and qualify. They can't graduate from the academy without qualifying. But when you look at the numbers of assaults on police officers in the United States, and I remember, I can picture every moment to this day of the first time I had an officer killed in the line of duty. Young, bright, talented, incredible shape, shot 13 times with his own handgun. Officers are routinely wounded and assaulted with their own guns. That's not true.
Gary Kleck is arguing for the motion, the liberal who works just from the numbers.
You know, here's a number for you, and it's a very easy number to understand. For the most recent year for which we have data, in the entire United States, there was exactly one police officer killed with his own gun. One. You can stretch the concept, happens routinely quite a bit, but I don't think one out of 600,000 police officers in the entire United States can really be described as routine. That's some indication of the chief's credibility when he says something happens frequently or routinely.
Let the chief respond.
Sure. I mean, actually, you'd have to be pretty stupid to assault an armed police officer who has a baton, a uniform,
indeed,
a radio,
would,
a gun, pepper spray, and extra ammunition, and is wearing body armor. That probably is quite correct. But there are very few, because of body armor and the changes in body armor in this country, there are very few police officers now killed or wounded in the line of duty at the numbers that we used to see.
Paul Helmke, as a former mayor of Fort Wayne to whom the police reported, were you surprised to hear Stephen Halbrook, who represents the NRA, say that police do not have a responsibility to protect individuals.
Steve's argument, at some extent, is true. People do have a right of self-defense. Supreme Court made that very clear in the Heller case. I do wonder a little bit about Justice Roberts' comments that he wasn't, he wanted to be able to shoot his gun, but he needed to turn on the light and put on his reading glasses before that. And that's the example Steve just gave. And I thought, gee, if the Chief Justice needs to put on his glasses and have his reading and turn the light on before he can shoot, maybe he shouldn't be shooting. But it gets into the issue of, yes, people
that
do
was
have
to take the trigger
a,
lock
people
off.
People do
Paul.
Have a right of self-defense. But what we do when we live in communities is we set up police departments because they're the individuals that are trained, they're the individuals that respond, and that often when an individual has a gun in their home, again, as I said, it's 22 times more likely to be used against them or family member. 20% of the time that an officer shot, it's his gun or his partner's, so you've got to expand that to the partner's gun. 20% of the time when an officer's in a shootout situation, they miss their target. Only 20%
you're running
of the time
a lot of
they
numbers.
Hit their
I want
target.
To give Stephen a chance to respond. Stephen Halbrook of the NRA.
There's something really bizarre about this picture that citizens with guns are totally incompetent and police with guns are totally incompetent and they're likely to be taken away from them, but somehow criminals are really good with guns. Where do they get all this training?
Well, they're not
There's
that good either.
There's something bizarre about this picture that citizens and police cannot defend themselves with guns, but criminals can successfully use guns to aggress against other people. It just doesn't make sense to say that you should never be able to protect yourself, that you shouldn't use a gun, that you're incompetent, that you're totally worthless with it, and it's just against any common sense.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. We're going to go to the audience for some questions now. There are a lot of hands up, and what we're going to do is take two or three questions. That one right there.
I was really interested. All these gentlemen seem to be old enough to have children over 18 or 21. I was wondering, would you recommend that your children keep a gun handy?
I hope my kids
have guns. This is John Lott answering.
I mean, I hope my kids have guns. I didn't own a gun until 1996, after I'd started doing the research. But at this point, given that I believe the benefits far outweigh the risks, I think I would be disappointed if my kids didn't own a gun.
Anybody on the other side respond to that?
I wouldn't want my daughters to have a gun.
That's Paul Helmke.
When I look at the statistics about how that adds to the risk of suicide, the risk of being misused, the risk of it coming up, being stolen, used in a domestic quarrel, I think it's just too much of a risk.
Down here?
Think that we're conflating statistical data about societies and societal factors with the guns themselves. So I'm not clear where you have had a concealed carry law put into place within that particular community. So you can hold constant for crack use or non-crack use, rural or urban. What has been the result? Does it reduce crime? Does it increase crime?
John Lott, you were going to answer the question that the questioner put
right.
to us about whether there is...
No, it's an excellent question, actually. And that's precisely what you want to do. You don't want to just compare across places because, Idaho is different than California and England has different underlying crime rate before they change any types of gun control laws than the United States has. And so what you're doing in these tests is you're precisely doing that. You're seeing how crime rates change in a state after that state's adopted right to carry laws and how that change is comparing to other places that didn't change their laws over that period of time. That's exactly the way that you want to do the test. And all the tests that I do, that's precisely
I'm
the
seeing
type
a great
test.
Deal of skeptical looks from the opposing table. John Donahue is taking this.
All the tests that John
does
show that crime gets better. But again, this is exactly what the National Academy of Science looked at. And they concluded the opposite.
Gil Kerlikowski, Chief.
Just within the last several months at one of the largest festivals in the city, the Folklife Festival, tens of thousands of people and literally dozens of police officers within spitting distance, in fact, of the crowd, a young man who had been on methadone, who had had a number of other problems, had a license issued by the sheriff in a neighboring county so that he could carry a concealed firearm anywhere. And in the middle of this crowd, he looked at someone, that person looked at him, and they got into a fight. night. The gun went off, and it not only discharged across the assailant, the gun also then ended up going through the hand of a young man and into the thigh of another woman. That is a person that should have never had a concealed firearms permit.
John Lott.
One question that keeps on coming up here, a point from the other side, is that people with concealed handgun permits, they may do bad things. And it's easy to check. In the state of Washington, you've had permits being issued since 1960. The type of incident where there was this wounding is the only case I know like that in the state of Washington. Nobody has been convicted of murder, for example, in Washington that's had a concealed carry permit. And you're talking about almost 50 years. And you see that in state after state. In Florida, you can go to the website for the department that issues permits, and they have detailed data there. You find that from October 1987 through September 31st of this year, they had issued over 1.41 million permits to 1.41 million people. Of those people, 166 had had their permits revoked for any type of firearms violation. Virtually all of those were for one type of violation, that was someone who accidentally carried a concealed handgun into a gun-free zone, like an airport or what have you.
It's interesting that Florida's brought up, though.
The
Sun Sentinel did a study in 2006, before the legislature closed off this website. This is the new move, by the way. But the Sun Sentinel found 216 people with active warrants, 128 with domestic violence restraining orders, 9 people charged with felonies or violent reckless misdemeanors, 6 registered sex offenders, at least one prison inmate, and another 1,400 people who had pled guilty or no contest to felony charges all had concealed carry permits in the state of Florida.
Notice what Paul's leaving out of that, though.
We don't want to make this information public anymore.
Gary Kleck says that Paul Hemke is leaving out of that.
You may have been listening for, well, how many people did something with their gun that they are now legally entitled to carry around in public places? How many times did they commit a violent crime in a public place? That's the only thing a carry permit allows you to do that you couldn't do without the permit. In fact, none of those people did a violent crime with a gun in a public place, and the fact that they had carry permits had absolutely nothing to do with anything. There was no harmful consequence of them getting those carry permits.
My question is for those who are in favor of the proposition. Isn't there a distinction between a handgun and a more excessive weapon like an AK-47?
Is an AK-47 something that people should have a right to carry around on the same terms as a handgun? Stephen Halbrook, who represents the NRA.
The Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms, and the question is what kinds of arms are constitutionally protected, and the Supreme Court just addressed that in the Heller case and said that handguns are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens historically for lawful purposes. The term AK-47 is very ambiguous. If it means a real AK-47, that means a fully automatic machine gun. They're very highly restricted in this country. They have to be registered with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. But that's really never where the debate has been. The debate has always been, for example, the Brady Center supporting the D.C. handgun ban. What people are concerned about is the ability to have a normal kind of gun in their house to protect themselves and to have rifles, pistols, and shotguns for sporting purposes or other lawful purposes. Real AK-47s, I don't know of anybody who advocates deregulating them under current federal law, which is very strict.
Steve, didn't you file something with the Supreme Court arguing that the machine gun ban was unconstitutional? I mean, you've argued that machine guns should be allowed, right?
This whole thing is really a red herring.
Let's let Stephen answer that. Okay. That was a question to Stephen.
Right. The National Firearms Act, passed in 1934, provides that certain kinds of highly restricted firearms can be registered and possessed by law-abiding citizens who go through these extreme background checks. And if you were to pass a ban on any kind of gun, it does raise questions under the Second Amendment as well as the Interstate Commerce Clause. There was a Supreme Court where we raised that issue. We did not argue that machine guns were protected by the Second Amendment. We argued that a constitutional issue is raised by whether they should be banned or not, and it's something that it had to do with a statutory interpretation. It's not a case that was a Second Amendment case. The only Second Amendment case the Supreme Court has dealt with is the Heller case, and it's decided that the kinds of guns that we're all ordinarily talking about here, rifles, pistols, and handguns are the ones that are, rifles, shotguns, and handguns are the ones that are constitutionally protected. These other issues are red herrings.
I want to point out where we are at this point. We've wrapped up the head-to-head section, and we are at the point, approaching the point where we need all of you to make the decision that decides how this evening ends. Let's to remind you, when you came in and we polled you on the motion, guns reduce crime, 13% of you agreed, 60% of you disagreed, and 27% were undecided. We have heard the bulk of the arguments and the back and forth, but now we're going to allow each panelist to sum up his position, beginning with the Seattle Chief of Police, Gil Kerlikowske.
John Locke told you that, well, people with concealed firearms rarely commit murders. Guess what? People that go through some type of check and go through a police department to get their concealed firearms permit don't go out and commit a lot of crimes. I can tell you that people with concealed firearms permits drive drunk with the gun in their holster in their car. People with concealed firearms permits in which we sent a clerk home because she issued one on a Monday, and on Friday when she was filing reports saw that the person had, after getting the permit, committed suicide with the gun within the same week. And one of our young women officers who talked a drunken woman out of a gun who was holding it to her head and her face and in her lap and finally was able to wrestle it away had just gotten her concealed firearms permits. I think reasonableness should enter into this. It should be more than just being upright and not being blind to allow you to carry a gun.
Thank you. Chief Kerlikowske of Seattle Chief of Police speaking against the motion. Speaking for the motion in his summarizing statement, John Lott, Senior Research Scholar at the University of Maryland.
You know, there are lots of things that affect crime, but we can deal with numbers on a lot of these things. We have anecdotal stories. The police chief just went through some. I advise you, you can go and check these things out. The Florida Department of issuing these concealed handgun permits has detailed records. You can go to their website. They'll go through year by year and tell you how many permit holders have been convicted for driving under the influence of alcohol. And it's an incredibly tiny number. The rate at which people lose their permits for any type of firearms-related violation, he gave examples of that, state after state, is hundreds or thousands of one percentage point. And I want to respond to John Donahue's comments about D.C. It's not true whether you look at rates or you look at numbers that you're going to see the murder rates fall or robbery rates fall after D.C.'s handgun ban. It goes up in either case. It just goes up more with the rate. And when he says it falls, what happens is, when you're just looking at the numbers, the numbers are falling quickly before the ban and rising relatively slowly after. And what he does is compare the before average and the after average, and that makes it look like the before average is higher than the after average. So it looks like, well, it's falling, but it's just the average. If you look at year by year, you see it's falling slowly and then rising faster afterwards.
Summarizing his position against the motion, John Donahue, economist and professor of law at Yale.
There are many features of the United States that would suggest we'd have one of the lowest rates of violent crime. Rich countries in general have low rates of violent crime. We're the richest. We have more people in prison than any other country in world history, yet our crime rate is phenomenally high, and you hear the proposition is that more guns would reduce crime. We have 42% of the world's guns in civilian hands in the United States. How many more would we need to get down to the level of crime of our European allies? They mentioned Switzerland and Israel. Again, these are completely inapposite. Switzerland has a regime in which individuals are in a militia. They take home an assault weapon, and they are given a locked container of ammunition that they're not allowed to open up. They have to repeatedly come to headquarters and show that they haven't opened it up. And if they have, they're put in jail. In Israel, they do put you in jail if you lose your gun. This is the problem. They keep ignoring the fact that between 500,000 and a million guns are stolen every year. That means a gun in a criminal's hands. Even if it's keeping you epsilon safer by having a gun, when your gun gets turned over a criminal, that's making everybody else more unsafe.
Thank you, John Donahue. Summing up his position for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Stephen Halbrook, attorney representing the NRA in several lawsuits.
Thank you, John. I want to respond to two things that Professor Donahue has stated. In the Heller case, the Supreme Court decided that the Second Amendment guarantees the individual right of individual citizens to keep and bear arms, including handguns. That's the position that the NRA has taken for many, many decades of its history, since 1871. And Mr. Donohue said that the NRA does not tell the truth on the Second Amendment. Well, then the Supreme Court doesn't either, because that's what the Supreme Court held in the Heller case. In addition, I've been to Switzerland many times and participated in shooting matches with military rifles, and you can buy all the ammunition you want at the shooting ranges and at gun shops. You're issued a tin of ammunition that you're not allowed to open because they want it to be available if the militia army has to be mobilized. But there's no restriction on your ammunition usage. Every Swiss male, when he enters age 20, is issued a military assault rifle, and he keeps it at home. The remaining thought I would like to say in favor of the proposition is I would like everybody to kind of think about yourself. You've heard here tonight that we're all potential murderers, that if we get angry, if we have a gun, we're going to kill somebody. It's just not true. Most people with these concealed weapon permits are just like you and me. They're normal people. They don't just suddenly get angry or have a couple of glasses of wine and go on murderous sprees.
Summing up his position against the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign and Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence.
The question you have to ask yourself is, did the other side prove its case? Did they prove that guns reduce crime? You haven't really heard any evidence to show that it did. And I think the question you should ask yourself to just get a gut check on this is, when you're at the next sporting event, when you're sitting in the restaurant, would you feel safer thinking that everyone had a gun or that no one had a gun? The reason you react that way is because you know instinctively that we make it too easy for dangerous people and people that don't know the responsibilities that go with guns to get guns. I ask the question, why aren't we the safest country in the world if we've got so many guns? It's because we make it too easy. We don't know where those guns are. We don't know who has the guns. Where do the guns come from that the bad guys, that the gang members get? They steal them from people like you. They steal them from gun stores who lose 30,000 guns every year. They get them through straw purchases. There are no limits on the number of guns you can buy at one time. There are very few limits on the type of guns you can buy. In most places in this country, there really are no laws. We make it too easy for dangerous people to get guns. The way to reduce crime is to do things like background checks, fight the illegal trafficking in guns, say that some guns should not be in the hands of the civilian population. Those are things that can help take down the crime rates in our communities, not flooding our communities with more guns. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul Helmke. And our final speaker, as we approach the moment of truth, speaking for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Gary Kleck, Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State.
You may remember I started out my opening remarks by saying you sometimes need to listen for the silences, and I think the panelists on the other side demonstrated that because they didn't, in fact, address the evidence that we presented. We cited some of the most thoroughly vetted scientific evidence we have on the question. Study after study repeatedly showed the same thing. It showed defensive gun use is common. It showed defensive gun use is effective. It's also a sign of a weakness of a particular position when people have to misstate what the issue is. Remember, the proposition was that guns reduce crime. Okay, do they make you safer to have a gun? Well, we didn't really hear anything about that. Instead, we hear Paul Helmke saying, would you feel comfortable with everybody having a gun? Well, of course, that's not the issue. Nobody here proposed that because, of course, everybody includes lunatics, convicted murderers, robbers, rapists, and so on. It's not the proposition. And in fact, no one here even secretly thinks that we ought to do that. It's not an issue. So why not confront the issue? Do guns reduce crime? Well, in fact, guns in the hands of non-criminals, guns in the hands of crime victims do make them safer.
That was Gary Kleck. Thank you. Now we are at the moment of truth. The results. Before the debate, 13% were for the motion, 60% were against, and 27% were undecided. After the debate, the side for the motion moved more of you, 27%. agree with the motion that guns reduce crime. 64% of you disagree, and now only 10% of you are undecided. So it was a close call with a little bit of an edge to those for the motion in terms of moving and changing minds. Congratulations to all of our panelists. This Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, presented by the Rosencrantz Foundation, was held on the campus of the Rockefeller University. Robert Rosencrantz is chairman, Dana Wolf is executive producer, Maureen McMurray is radio producer, Damon Whitmore is the audio engineer, and I'm your host, John Donvan. For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit www.intelligencesquaredus.org. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.